Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. Studio live audience. It's August 12th, 2014. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN FM. Our theme song, Nature Bats Last, is provided with our thanks by Afrizen, A-F-R-I-Z-E-N. And you can find more of his work on the SoundCloud or at soundcloud.com. I'm Mike Sliva, along with the good doctor, Guy McPherson. On today's show, we'll cover a lot of terrain, but again, because we're fairly new at this and sometimes we don't even know when we're on the air, we will again start with some brief bios so you know who we are and where we're coming from. I'm a former high school teacher who 3 years ago walked away from a world of credit scores, cars, cell phones, and employment and moved towards a life of community, intent, and connection. My wife and I live semi-nomadically in our Mongolian gare, or our AKA really nice tent. And for the past 3 years, we've spent a significant part of our time working on different homesteads for room and board, attempting to improve our durable living skills while maintaining our collective sanity. I write and speak on issues concerning privilege and its relationship with the industrial model, and you can find out more about me and my work at michaelsliwa.wordpress.com. Guy, who are you?
I've been wondering that for years myself. I'm Professor Emeritus of Conservation Biology at the University of Arizona, where I taught and field ecology and climate change for 2 decades. I left active service more than 5 years ago to establish an off-grid homestead in southern New Mexico. Since leaving Tucson, I've been able and willing to write and speak from an increasingly radical perspective. We received a lot of feedback from last week's premiere episode. In fact, the podcast had more than 1,100 listens when I last checked. Thanks to everybody who submitted unsolicited comments. We read every one and will continue to try to integrate the ones we like.
Okay, again, enough about us. On to our first segment tonight, which highlights news beyond the mainstream. There's plenty going on in the Middle East, the Ukraine, Robin Williams, the Kardashian world, Ebola, you name it. This segment will from time to time add to those stories, but we'll go a little deeper to find the root of these stories. For example, the root of our resource wars and water struggles. So we give you the not so mainstream headline news. Guy, give us your first headline, author, and story.
All right, I was going to relay information about the ongoing disasters in the Middle East, as indicated in the description of this week's program. But it's no longer news that the current presidential administration has orders dropped provided the United States. If you haven't noticed by now that the U.S. is an empire in decline looking to save face, you're not really paying the slave. So I've dredged up a story from Jim Collins' 2001 book, Good to Great, retold yesterday by Tim Price at Sovereign Man, titled Story about James Stockdale, who was shot down over North Vietnam in September 1965 and captured as a prisoner of war. He would spend the next 7 years in the infamous Hanoi Hilton. In conducting research for his book, Collins asked Stockdale who didn't make it out. "Oh, that's easy," replied Stockdale. "The optimists." Collins was confused. "The optimists," repeated Stockdale. "Oh, they were the ones who said, we're going to be out by Christmas. And Christmas would come and Christmas would go. Then they'd say, we're going to be out by Easter. And Easter would come and Easter would go. And then Thanksgiving. And then Christmas again and they all died of a..." This is a very important lesson, Stockdale says. You must confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. I think this is a great story for our message, particularly in light of tonight's program. Mike, what do you got?
My not-so-mainstream headline news item first appeared in Yes Magazine, and then I found it republished in the August 6th edition of Truth Out at truth-out.org. The headline reads, Lakota Women Work to Fend Off South Dakota's Epic Drought, and it was written by Kristen Moe. And it takes place on the Cheyenne River Reservation, home of the Lakota tribe of the same name. And Candace Ducheneau is one of the leaders of an organization called MNI, M-N-I, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which means water in Lakota. And they're working on an ambitious water conservation project, constructing a series of small dams from the help of about 24 volunteers from around the country. And the goal of the organization is really to bring the Cheyenne River's water table back into balance. And so what they're doing essentially is building beaver dams with human hands. So organizers hope to slow storm runoff long enough to enable the water to absorb back into the ground. True to its Lakota roots, MNI is rooted in Teospe, the Lakota word for extended family, and the organization is made up of Candace and her daughters, Karen and Cayenne, and her son Luke, his wife Linda, and nearly all of their children. They started off small with a pilot project on a small parcel of land, and if successful, they hope to build similar dams all over the Cheyenne River and train workers from other reservations in South Dakota to create a model of water restoration that can be replicated anywhere. They have a big vision for this project, and for her, Candace, South Dakota's depleted aquifer is just one small part of the global problem of water cycles interrupted by, you guessed it, human industry. It's just one of the little micro projects. It's not just one little micro project, she says. It's all the land in the world that has to be put into water restoration. And it's a fitting story considering our guest this evening.
Tonight we are honored to have two active members of Deep Green Resistance, both based in Tucson, but serving the international Deep Green Resistance effort. Mary and Charles both serve in the administrative committee. In addition, Charles is the Deep Green Resistance membership coordinator and a head interviewer with the personnel committee. He also coordinates the male mentorship project. Mary is head interviewer with the personnel committee and a member of the women's and media committee. Welcome, Mary and Charles. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Guy.
Yeah, thank you.
Some of our listeners know little or nothing about Deep Green Resistance. Tell us a little bit about DGR. What's the mission, and what approaches are used to further that mission?
Well, we are a social justice environmental organization, really the first of its kind. We are seeking to amplify the voices of folks that have been marginalized in other environmental organizations. And our mission is really to take down industrial civilization, in brief.
Yeah.
Charles?
I mean, I feel like we could talk about this for a pretty long time, but to cut to the chase, as Mary said, the mission is to agitate for the goal of bringing down industrial civilization by any means necessary. And we mean this. You know, this includes advocating for the necessity of underground action, promoting underground action and normalizing it. You know, basically, we need to stop industrialism in its tracks. But we also realize that a sufficient strategy for achieving a just outcome would also call to build direct democracies and, you know, sustainable material cultures. And this means that branches of the resistance movement must work in tandem, you know, above ground and below ground activists, the militants and the nonviolent, the frontline activists, as well as the cultural workers. To be clear, though, we are an above ground organization, and there must always be a firewall between us and an underground that may come to exist.
Okay, that's great. You each have several titles, and they can be a little confusing. What are your actual roles? What do you actually do on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis? And maybe we can start with Mary and then move on to Charles. How do you work to facilitate DGR's mission on a regular daily basis?
Well, on a regular daily basis, much of the work of Deep Green Resistance membership is unglamorous and behind the scenes. It involves a lot of communications, you know, utilizing email as long as we have it for a higher good, coordinating volunteers, a lot of public relations publicity, community education writing. Our projects are really diverse. We are a global organization, and our membership is pretty self-directed and, you know, highly intuitive as far as how it functions. But we do have an administrative committee that deals with a lot of the nuts and bolts of keeping operations going. We also have a steering committee that's comprised of four members and the three people that are on our advisory board, and we have an advisory board.
Yeah, and what I deal with is coordinating the whole process for potential new members to join. So that includes screening, training, new interviewers, and, you know, really making sure that people who are coming into the organizing space are high quality, top notch people who really understand what we're talking about.
I would imagine, this is Mike, I would imagine, Charles, that's quite a process, because, I mean, is it an interview process? Is it several interviews? How does something like that work?
Yeah. What happens is we send somebody who's interested in joining a packet of required reading to make sure that they know all our stances, everything we're talking about. They then also at the same time get sent a series of questions ranging from, you know, philosophical understanding to where they may live. And then if they are approved through that, then we move on to a interview. And this goes on for, it's about an hour long to 2 hour long interview. If they are approved, then they join the organization.
And part of this process, Michael, is also about carrying out our guiding principles, making sure that our guiding principles, that we're all on the same page about what those principles
right.
are, as well as our code of conduct. We do have a code of conduct. Healthy groups generally do. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are creating healthy human community and safe spaces for all our members. So that's a big part of why we do spend time getting to know folks a bit and going over those sorts of things.
Right. I mean, because let's be clear to our what about here is of many is pretty heavy stuff. The strategy, you know, DGR uses decisive ecological existence of an unknown take modes of industrial infrastructure, playing offense in defense of the living earth. So, I mean, how, I guess, for a personal question, how do you justify this personally, morally, and strategically in your own lives?
Right. And that's something that, you know, each member of Deep Green Resistance has grappled with and come to clarity about. You know, one thing that most of all your listeners know is that, you know, the rate of decline is accelerating, industrially accelerated. Global warming and biosphere catastrophe is on the time, you know, we're out of time. And this understanding that so much has been lost already, 98% of old growth forests gone, 90% of the fish in the sea gone, indigenous cultural genocide, you know, ongoing. And so as we've grappled with this, we've also come to understand that each day industrialism, capitalism, and industrially accelerated global warming is harming life. We have, you know, whatever it is. Is it 20 million people a year dying from air pollution? Some 500,000 dying from relocation, distress due to catastrophic weather, We have those factors, and you know, the fact is that the decline, the dying of non-human species is around 1,000 times its normal rate, 200 species a day or so, and you know, we are in a midst of an extinction. But the part about the industrially accelerated part, the civilization machine of it, that is the part that we feel we must tackle. And because it apparently we're looking at life being murdered on this planet down to biome level. So I myself, the green resistance.
In a culture full of hope and in the forms of technology, wishful thinking, and a great awakening by the industrial power structure, meaning, quite frankly, ourselves, in what Derek Jensen calls a culture of make-believe, some important voices are speaking truth to power. Each week we will have brief opinion pieces.
Expose some truth that has been widely hidden, ignored, or filed under the oblivious for the general populace. This week we have two contributors again. We again have Lindsay Morrison, who describes the alienation resulting from industrial civilization. And we conclude with Forrest Palmer, who compares release of high levels of carbon dioxide in 1986 to contemporary events. This is called Breaking Hopium.
The way I see it, human beings are just like any other animals that evolved in social groups. They basically just want to eat, sleep, mate, and avoid having their jugular ripped out. And the way they avoid that is usually by paying close attention to the body language of the group around them. Industrial civilization created so much separation and noise that our natural senses are dulled. If I had to choose again, I would still be a doomer because it does enrich my life. The hardest part is when I try to share what I learned with my family, and on one hand, they'll nod that they understand the simple concept that we can't destroy forever without consequences. But when they return to their regular routine, they're bombarded again with all the illusions, and what I try to say is outnumbered by what's considered normal. Satisfying relationships usually involve a mutual respect and support, but doomers are often treated like what we care about is at best just a mental quirk that the family tolerates. You're supposed to meet them on their terms and keep your disturbing theories to yourself. We try to cultivate more compassion than resentment, but sometimes for our own sanity, we have to withdraw. Because empty relationships are, they're worse than being alone. So it means a lot to me to be part of this show, and thanks for listening.
We now move to Forrest to compare his release of high levels of carbon with to 1986 contemporary events.
The thought of the morning is about the inane and even more so insane belief in carbon sequestration. As Westerners think of so-called innovative technology to stave off the impending doom of the current industrial civilization, we're starting to come up with more and more harebrained schemes to keep things on an even keel. With even keel being defined as continuing to do untold damage to the environment without collapse happening. Of course, the belief is that this collapse won't happen because of generational innovation increasing as time goes on. Regarding this cultural god complex found in Western society, and particularly onerous in America, it is to laugh. Anyhow, in a nod to this chaotic journey of mystical innovation, carbon sequestration, also known as carbon capture and storage, basically involves taking the emissions from their primary source of factories, power plants, refineries, etc., stripping the emissions of its carbon, and storing the carbon underground in various locations across the Earth that are allegedly safe. That being said, for anyone who has a belief that this is a possibility outside of the infrastructure issues, resource scarcity, the emissions it will take to build such monstrosities across the Earth, and this is a global problem, I only have two words for you, Lake Niles. Niles is a lake in the country of Cameroon that emits carbon due to a pocket of magma lying underneath the surface. On August 21st, 1986, an eruption below the lake caused a carbon dioxide plume to emit from Niles. Its estimated concentration ranged from 100,000 to 300,000 tons and even up to 1.2 million tons of carbon dioxide. With a thickness of about 160 feet and speed of 12 to 31 miles per hour, this gaseous bulb hugged the ground as carbon dioxide is heavier than oxygen and made its way to the surrounding area where it eventually asphyxiated 1,700 people as well as 3,500 livestock. Not good. Not good at all. Therefore, to put the proverbial 2 + 2 together, any dunderhead can see that it wouldn't be a good thing to place carbon emissions beneath our feet as an answer to climate change, ocean acidification, air pollution, or any of the other issues that are becoming more and more problematic with each passing day as we do nothing. However, the layman's supposition may be that this isn't too terrible. There's only a mere 1.2 million tons of carbon dioxide at worst that killed all those people in Cameroon. What is the big deal? Of course, this response almost always comes from people who don't know the raw numbers concerning the daily details of sustaining our energy consumption. Let me help out with this. According to the International Energy Agency, world CO2 emissions were 31.6 billion tons in 2012. Doing basic back-of-the-envelope calculations, this means that the gaseous cloud that killed hundreds of people and livestock in a relatively sparse area in Cameroon is emitted approximately every second to 14 seconds by this industrial civilization, depending on which estimate someone wants to use regarding the catastrophe of Lake Niles. Therefore, the plan touted by many is to place not even a one-time emission of 31.6 billion tons of carbon into the earth beneath us, but to do this every year as some type of sustainable situation. And to break this down even further, in no uncertain terms, every second to 14 seconds, the Western world is attempting to place an amount of gas in the ground that has already proven to kill 1,700 people and 3,500 livestock. And it will be the Earth, since at the very least the powers that be who run these schemes decided not to store these emissions underwater because of what happened at Lake Niles in 1986. Of course, no fool would think that it is possible to capture all 31.6 billion tons of carbon dioxide and place it in the Earth. Although, in all honesty, I'm saying this as a comparatively sane individual, and we must now recognize that insanity drives this society more than anything else. Being as it may, it begs the question, does this society that has pinned its hopes on innovation want to capture three-quarters of these CO2 emissions, or half, or a tenth? Who knows? This is all one big crapshoot at this juncture, and just like the casino, no matter how lucky or even good that you may be, the house always wins, and Mother Nature is the house. So the next time some scientific genius or delusional environmentalist mentions carbon storage or carbon sequestration as one of many asinine answers to our environmental issues, please tell them the tale of Lake Niles. I doubt it will make even an infinitesimal dent in the path going forward or even in the typical Western brain. But once the future becomes the present and these schemes are revealed to be the rantings of a mass society with no basis in reality, these individuals may be able to say a number of things in response to these revelations, except one. That they were not told the truth.
Right. Thanks, Forrest Palmer. And thanks, Lindsay Morrison, before Forrest. So we're back to our interview with Mary and Charles with Deep Green Resistance now. Tell us what it is about the DGR philosophy and community resistance organizing that offers you the most meaning, the most hope, if you will, at this late stage of this biosphere emergency. What has compelled you to dedicate yourselves to this work?
Well, really, I mean, what really compelled me to come to DGR was a couple things. The statement of principles, the code of conduct, you know, laying out there, this is exactly what we think, this is what we are looking for, this is what we really believe in. And then the DEW, Decisive Ecological Warfare, was a huge draw to me. I really think it's the only chance we have to avert total death of all life on the planet. And oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I thought Mary might have something to tag on there.
I'm sure she does.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, having spent about, 30 years in different social justice activism through birth activism and midwifery orientation as my expression of stewardship and activism. Early last year, I just updated myself on some things and also encountered Deep Green Resistance. And, you know, the first time I encountered the phrase, it resonated like a mother tongue. And I have made the decision to basically refocus my midwifery skills and talents and education and my knowledge into this movement. I do feel that we are at a really, you know, extremely critical time for human community and culture, as well as the issue of the survival of life on this planet. And so I made the decision to focus on helping midwife this movement, helping resistance be born, helping contribute to healthy human community. And so we in our membership, we have interesting stories with different members, a huge range of people. Some of our members are around 70 years old even, who have also come to similar a similar crossroads, I'd say, with regard to their profession and vocation, and feeling that they really need to join together in resistance. So,
thanks. Now, about a year ago, there was a significant issue involving feminism that brought DGR to the public's attention, and it brought me to the public's attention as well. In fact, I was roundly criticized for being supported by DGR and for supporting DGR because of that issue. Give us a little background on the issue. Tell us how DGR was impacted by the issue. To the story, I encourage our listeners to read the story titled "What is a Woman?" in the August 4th, 2014 issue of the New Yorker. So go ahead, Mary.
Yeah. Well, you know, regardless of kerfluffles or lack of kerfluffles around feminism in social justice movements, the fact is that we really need roots-oriented feminism in order to effectively resist the male violation imperative that is killing the living planet in its industrialism, its geopolitical militarism, and its destruction and murdering of the land. And, you know, the industrial infrastructure of oppression is full-spectrum dominance. And we need full-spectrum resistance that fights for the liberation of women as well as the earth, because the way that the land is treated and the way that the women are treated, it's all connected. And so I'm not interested really in talking further about whether or not people understand the need to be allies of real feminism. It's just a waste of time to discuss something so basic to social justice sensibility and political resistance. Unless it's strongly feminist, it's not radical, and we need radical. We need to be dealing with the roots of industrial ecocide, not just the symptoms, and we need to amplify the voices of women, most especially indigenous women and women of color.
Great. Thanks for that response. It's interesting. Some fungi have more than 30,000 genders, but most humans seem to believe that two are enough for us. To change topics a little bit, the Environmental Institute is organizing its nearly annual conference in San Francisco this November. It's titled Earth at Risk, the Justice and Sustainability Conference, and the program just screams DGR, at least to me. Is there a connection between DGR and the Fertile Ground Environmental Institute? And if so, can you tell us a little bit about the connection and the conference?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Fertile Ground Environmental Institute is not affiliated with DGR. Although several of its members have been involved with DGR, you know, in different times and capacities. Most of the speakers at Earth at Risk in the DGR, and, you know, in cases they haven't even heard of DGR. You know, Fertile Ground Environmental Institute is an independent and internationally respected nonprofit, and it focuses on, you know, really promoting innovative approaches in activism, mainly through, you know, conferences like Earth at Risk. And from what I understand, it was really created, you know, because the response by the culture it's incredibly inadequate to deal with the problems we face. It's just incredibly inadequate. So, you know, they decided to put on a conference that would have the integrity to really and truly face these problems that humanity and the world are up against. And, you know, it's taking... I'd like to add that the line of speakers is just absolutely phenomenal and out of this world.
And what's really amazing is it is a grant-funded conference, conference tickets are $40 for the whole weekend
right now.
You know, the early bird tickets, which is, it makes it really accessible. So it's, we will be honored to, you know, be gathering with several indigenous chiefs, as well as yourself, Guy, and Chris Hedges, Derek Jensen, and Saba Malik, who is also on the DGR advisory board.
Okay, great. So it, the existence of that independent organization, institute, and their conference, it sounds like good news from a from DGR's perspective, since you seem to be converging on the crisis at hand. So DGR claims to be a social DGR claims to be a social justice, environmental philosophy, and activist organization. That's quite a mouthful. Social justice, environmental philosophy, and activist organization. What does that mean? Can you fill us in a little bit there?
For sure. You know, really what it comes down to, the truth of it is that we are addressing enmeshed systems of oppression. That, you know, what we're facing with ecocide, what we're facing with the way that the land and women are treated, is operating as like a perpetual motion machine. And the systems of oppression that it, you know, runs on are very interconnected. So Deep Green Resistance is addressing this with a full range of strategies and a diverse membership. Charles, you have more to say about that?
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at it, the social justice is the environmental justice. You know, masculinity with its violation imperative and its will to dominate is affecting people of color, the land, women, non-humans. It's the same thing. And really, we have multiple different things we're talking about. To me, though, you know, really the most exciting thing is that I think we have an actual chance with the strategy that we're promoting. You know, we're promoting the necessity of a militant, organized, strategic, and humane underground that can target key nodes of industrial infrastructure.
And, you know, Deep Green Resistance is about resilience through resistance as well. You know, resistance is integral to healthy community at this stage of the environmental movement and the planetary emergency. You know, as you yourself have said, Guy, resistance is fertile. And, you know, we need all hands on deck. We are all in the same boat, or really the same, we're all on the same mothership with an industrially accelerated biosphere catastrophe. This is not about individualist little lifeboats. We're all on this planet together, and we all rely on the life that this planet gives us. So there is this intersection, you know, this connectedness about resistance and resilience. It doesn't need to be either or, it can be both. So Deep Green Resistance also has, you know, a strategy for rebuilding. Say we do survive, you know, rebuilding and learning about resilient living is part of our process. It's really the second part after resistance, but many of our members are permaculture gardeners. Many of our members are, you know, living simply and concerned about resilience simultaneously.
Excellent. This is Mike again, and really to kind of conclude, I mean, really what this comes down to, at least in my opinion, and maybe yours as well, is I guess what thus far do you think in your that the impact that Deep Green Resistance is having on the industrial model up to this point?
That's a great question. We're definitely building a culture of resistance and normalizing resistance. We are finding that conversations amongst environmentalists, social justice folks, interfaith folks, conversations are changing, And the fact that what we've been doing thus far hasn't been working, and that the possibility, the concept of resistance is starting to spread. And we have, you know, at this point, you know, we've gotten some publicity in the mainstream world. We're getting membership inquiries every day from some high caliber, you know, great folks. And so we have a four-phase plan, you know, decisive ecological warfare is a four-phase plan. And we are presently transitioning from phase one to phase two, basically. You know, we've started the conversation's spreading, and we are able to advocate for the strategy on a larger scale. Charles,
do
you have something?
And as far as, like, what Deep Green Resistance as an above-ground organization has done to affect industrialism, not much, because what we're really going to have to rely on here is a militant underground force that can take out key nodes of industrial infrastructure. That's really what we have to rely on. You know, it is a war, and they are only, those in power are only going to stop when we make them, when people make them, when people hit them strategically, materially. And these people in past resistance movements, the percentage of people who actively resisted was very low, and the people who actively took up arms in successful resistance movements were even lower. We're talking like 1 to 3% percentage points of people who took up arms. So we truly believe that we have a chance here.
And something really unique about Deep Green Resistance is the concept of security culture, the importance of keeping a firewall, a complete disconnection between the legal above ground movement of Deep Green Resistance and any unknown theoretical underground which may exist or come to exist. We constantly remind ourselves of this, educate on it, and focus on it, because we found with successful resistances of the past, problems happened whenever things were blurry between the two. And frankly, you know, the vast majority of people that come to Deep Green Resistance are very reassured by this. They want to stay above ground. They want to be legal. And at the same time, we're all praying or hoping or intending for some unknown individuals who are super smart and highly ethical to carry out the last phases of the decisive ecological warfare strategy in defense, self-defense, and defense of the defenseless, not in any kind of self-aggrandizing way. DGR stands for universal human rights, and we're very clear that, you know, an ethical and savvy militancy needs to be born.
Okay, final question, briefly. How can individuals and organizations support Deep Green Resistance? Short of sending you lots and lots of money.
Well, really, this is the call out to everybody. All the lifeboaters, all the, you know, not in my backyard people, all the permaculturalists. Why aren't you resisting? What can make you morally impacted to truly resist? We have to. It's a moral imperative.
And we've got a full range of ways to do that. Some members focus exclusively on the library system, getting the books into the library system so that people can have access to the Deep Green Resistance analysis and strategy. And some people focus on cultural art, resistance art. Some people focus on community education workshops, film nights.
And you don't have to join DGR to do this stuff, but we need people to come in mass, in arms, and support resistance. So, and at the very least, not to disavow militancy.
And interestingly, what we're finding, the good chunk of us, we have found that through organizing for resistance, we are becoming more resilient. It's ironic, but true, that in my experience at least, and Charles is nodding his head. So thanks for asking that question.
Sure. That wraps up our long interview this week. This time we were joined by Mary and Charles of Deep Green Resistance out of Tucson. We're going to move on to our next segment. Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo in their rhetoric or analysis, but may also provide insightful and useful information to the issues at hand. Our doomer for this week is Forrest Castagna, who writes in the Doomer Party 2016 group on Facebook, quote, "We should start a pool on how long it is before researchers and government officials start urging mass orchestrated suicide. Off the cuff, I say September 2015, end quote. Thanks for the comment, Forrest. We love comments that make us seem like a couple of Pollyannas. Speaking of Doomers, Mike, what's the word from comedian Louis C.K.?
I contacted Louis C.K.'s booking agent on August 8th, and so we're going to start a count on the program of how long it takes to get Louis C.K.'s response and then potentially get him on the show. Right now, the count is 4 days. Back to you, Guy.
We like to close out most of our shows with a climate change summary and update that can also be found at NatureBatsLast, GuyMcPherson.com. Instead of an update, this week I respond to a question posted on Facebook by Dylan. The question is, what's the latest forecast on when the El Nino is likely to occur? I'd appreciate it if you could explain to your audience just what this phenomenon is in layman's terms and what the probable effect will be on climate conditions. That's a great question, Dylan. Thanks for asking. Those of you with questions for us can post them on the Facebook page, the Facebook group, or at GuyMcPherson.com. To respond, Dylan, according to the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center, chances of an El Nino this fall and winter, that's fall and winter in the Northern Hemisphere, have fallen to about 65%. At this time, the consensus of forecasters expects El Nino to emerge during August through October, that's this month, obviously, through October, and to peak at weak strength during late fall and early winter. An El Nino event is a disruption of the ocean atmosphere system in the tropical Pacific that suddenly releases heat stored in the ocean. This one is expected to account for a rise in global average temperature of somewhere between 0.5 and 0.9 degrees centigrade. Those are big numbers. Consider, for example, that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the planet has warmed 0.85 degrees centigrade. So an additional increase of half a degree to 0.9 C is a big number. A major El Nino event accounts for 1998 being the only one of the top 10 warmest years in planetary history that predates the year 2000. Every other one of the top 10 years, nine of the top 10 have been post-2000. It was only during an especially strong El Nino in 1998 that got 1998 or any year before the year 2000 in the top 10. So among the consequences of El Ninos are increased rainfall across the southern tier of the United States and also Peru. In the past, these events have caused destructive flooding, and drought in the western Pacific is sometimes associated with devastating brush fires in Australia. So that's our climate change summary and update for this week.
We encourage you to ask questions during the broadcast and prior to the broadcast the week prior. And that's a great example of something getting answered on the air that's very informative. That about does it for this week. We'd like to thank our guests from DGR, Charles and Mary. We'd like to thank again Lindsay and Forrest. And make sure that you like us on Facebook at Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM group on Facebook as well. And again, we're looking for those questions. Finally, if you find yourself in need of support in dealing with these heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook and join the conversation. There are plenty of people who are going through similar emotional strains and the roller coaster, so to speak, and can help provide some personal insight to these monumental issues. In fact, a couple of days ago in that particular group, Amy Pike wrote the following: Finding out about near-term extinction and how very near-term it is, that is a burden that has been very hard for me to carry alone. And just want to say how very grateful I am, while the lights are still on, that I have this forum and the people here to come to who also know how real and how serious this is and how little time we have left. At least here, I can have a place to go where my fears and concerns are not shrugged off or not taken seriously, but have other educated people who know what the hell is going on. Well said, Amy, and thank you. Well, we'll see you next Tuesday evening, and if you miss us, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats Last, as always. Thanks again to Afrazin for our theme song, and thanks for listening.
oven.